Welcome to the Yoga Beyond the Poses Telesummit, a series of conversations designed to explore and illumine the yogic sciences and how they help us find happiness and freedom, creating health, wealth, and grace in our lives. This is Sarah Hutchinson, and I'm your hostess, and I'm absolutely thrilled to introduce our special guest speaker, Sally Kempton. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Sarah. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
So pleased to have you in the conversation. We have so much to talk about. Let me cover your bio for our listeners. Sally is one of today's most authentic spiritual teachers. She teaches devotional contemplative tantra, an approach to practice that creates a fusion of knowing and loving. Known for her ability to transmit inner experience through transformative practices and contemplation, Sally's been practicing and teaching for 40 years. She was a disciple of the great Indian guru, Swami Muktananda. Sally spent 20 years as a teaching Swami in the Saraswati order of Indian monks. In her guru's ashram, she received a traditional training in yoga philosophy and practice and became a popular teacher, deeply versed in the teachings and practices of Vedanta and Kashmir Shaivism. In 2002, Sally began teaching independently, and she now offers heart-to-heart transmission in meditation and life practice through her Awakened Heart Tantra workshops, teleclasses, retreats, and trainings in applied spiritual philosophy. Sally's workshops and teleconference courses integrate the wisdom of traditional yoga tantra with the insights of contemporary evolutionary spirituality and cutting-edge psychology. And just to finish it off, Sally is the author of Meditation for the Love of It, a groundbreaking book on meditation, which Spirituality and Health called the meditation book your heart wants you to read. Sally writes a regular column called Wisdom for Yoga Journal. Many of you will be familiar with that. And she teaches her monthly teleclasses in meditation and an ongoing teleconference series called The Transformative Practice Journey, which unfolds different aspects of awakening practice. Sally is one of a select group of teachers in Ken Wilber's Integral Spiritual Center and teaches regularly at conferences at Kripalu as well as Esalen. Wow, and I get to talk with you, Sally, and everybody else gets to listen in. I'm just so happy to have you here. I've learned so much from your books, your teleconferences, and certainly in prepping for this interview, I took you on as a teacher. So thanks for being with us.
I think we're going to have a fabulous time, Sarah. It's been great, the conversation so far, and I know that with everyone listening in, it's going to be even better.
Good. Yeah, we've designed this telesummit to get to the heart of how yoga can lead us to deep self-wisdom and to the landscape beyond that self-wisdom. And that's what we'd love to unfold. So let's do that now, shall we?
Let's do it.
Okay, so this is a question that, just for our listeners, I cleared this question with Sally because it's something I have been so curious about. I wonder if many of you are too, and here it is. I'm curious what inspired you to leave the monastic contemplative life and come out into this complicated world, and do you ever wish you could go back?
Well, to answer your last question, no. I actually am fortunate enough to have kind of a contemplative life in a kind of an uncomplicated part of the world, and I actually find that there are qualities about my life here that are in certain ways more contemplative and retreat-like than they were when I was living in the ashram. If anyone of your listeners has ever lived in an ashram, you know that the idea that ashrams are quiet and contemplative is a misnomer, because actually in most ashrams, the people who live there work their butts off pretty much all day long. It's actually part of the practice there. So I decided to leave I actually, when I got in, when I first got involved in, you know, the full court press spiritual life with my teacher, Swami Muktananda, he was quite old, and I knew that he would not be in the world so long. And I decided that I wanted to stay with him as long as he was alive, serve him and learn from him. And I made a kind of a deal with myself that I was actually very conscious. I remember the moment when I did it, which was that, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to let, you know, the issues of my, let's call it my karmic life go and just be a full-time spiritual practitioner, whatever that means. But at some point, I'm going to come back and re-enter my life, deal with the issues that might not have gotten dealt with, and you know, and bring whatever I learned to the world. So it was kind of inevitable, you know, how when you have a certain intention, sometimes it takes a while for it to be fulfilled, but it always is, I think, fulfilled in the end. And part of what I have found happens, and we can talk about this in more detail, is that as you follow the spiritual journey, the journey of the inner yoga, there you come to certain gateways where you have to go, you know, the only way you can go through that gate is through guidance that comes from inside. In other words, nobody, no teacher, no book, no friend can actually help you follow the you know, breadcrumb trail of your own path. And that happened to me at a certain point. I just realized that to go farther, to go deeper, required that I leave the context of the structure and, you know, plunge into my own journey on my own. So it's, you know, the living there was beautiful and incredibly instructive and powerful. And the life I live now is also beautiful and instructive and powerful. And
what a, beautiful, what a beautiful evolutionary perspective on this arc of life and the arc of your practice.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I have really come to appreciate is that there are not mistakes. You know, assuming that your intention is to grow and that you're willing to take responsibility for your own actions, then pretty much everything that comes up in your life is going to take you deeper if you're really willing to approach it in a contemplative way.
That is such a powerful statement, and I know that as you and I were preparing for this interview, we touched on this relative to student-teacher relationship. So what if we go there now and draw this sutra, this thread that you've brought forward into this idea of student-teacher relationship. You've spoken to it because you were in a deep guru relationship when you were with Muktananda. And you said that it had its place in your life and played itself out, if you will, and brought you to a place of self-knowing that you then launched from. What could you then leave with our listeners about the student-teacher relationship, which, of course, is a very touchy subject in the West and in the yoga world?
Yeah, and it's a very complex subject. I'm part of a generation that, how shall I say, plunged deeply into traditional student-teacher relationships, often with Eastern teachers. A lot of the, you know, Buddhist teachers my age and the teachers my age from the Indian traditions had long-term teacher-student relationships with somebody from Asia, you know, from India or Thailand or Tibet. So I, and, you know, as many of my contemporaries, really plunged in an extremely profound, powerful, and ultimately transformative way into the kind of student-teacher relationship which is really hardly possible in, you know, between contemporary Westerners. One reason, of course, is because these traditional teachers came from, they really held a tradition that, you know, was profoundly respectful of authority, and they come out of cultures where there's a family structure in which the, you know, basically a patriarchal family structure in which dad is the head of the family in every sense of the word. And those gurus, the whole guru tradition in the East, guru disciple tradition in the East, is based really on that paradigm of human relationships. And if you look at it in terms of a traditional family structure, you could say, and okay, now I'm just going to speak for myself, that when I first became involved in the spiritual journey, I was really, as they say, raw. In other words, I'd had a kind of classic, you know, kind of post-conventional bohemian New York lifestyle, had a career, I'd been a journalist, I considered myself very culturally sophisticated, and I really had no spiritual discipline whatsoever, and not much of an idea about what spiritual life was about. The people I knew who were spiritual or monastic were mostly contemplative Catholics and, you know, very different people than I was. So when I had my first awakening, which was kind of dramatic and very, very powerful, I happened to be in a position where I could, because I was a freelance journalist, I didn't have a job, I knew that I could leave my career and come back to it. You know, that's one of the beauties of being a writer. So I just went for it. And my first experience of a teacher actually was a Chinese Tai Chi master whom I knew in Los Angeles. And the thing that really deeply impressed me about him was his utter absolute rigor about the practice. So, you know, this is the 70s, and even having a daily discipline, you know, where I practiced the Tai Chi form 4 or 5 times a day, was totally radical and transformative for me in so many ways. So when I actually met the teacher who was to become my guru, I was very drawn to, very interested in careful, rigorous discipline. And I was, you know, actually kind of in love with the structures of yoga, not so much the hatha yoga asana style, but the you know, kind of meditative, contemplative style, which is what my teacher specialized in. So there was something about that traditional relationship, which it's like putting yourself into a mold, or, you know, like fencing a young tree when it's in a growing stage. Creating the structure allows for you to let go of distractions. It allows for you to put aside your ideas about what's true and what's not true, because the nature of that traditional relationship is that for a period of time you accept what the teacher says. You know, you do what the teacher says, and sometimes it's the last thing you want to do. Sometimes, you know, looking back on it, from a psychological point of view, it may not even be particularly healthy. But what it teaches you from a spiritual viewpoint is constantly, always, to look into yourself, into your own reactions, into your own deeper motivations, into the things that keep you from really acting from your own essence, from your own truth. And a really great teacher, a teacher who has the stature to be called a guru, and there are not that many of them, is going to be constantly standing in essence, in truth, in the self, so that when you're in that teacher's presence, you're always, it's like being in the presence of a tuning fork that aligns you to the part of yourself that is not bullshitted by, you know, by the various distractions and conditions and psychological issues that are our normal way of looking at the world. So for me, that alignment, the presence of that radically enlightened human being in my life, it seemed to me that it was necessary for me to have that radical a guru-disciple relationship for a period of time, and I'm very, very grateful for it. Now, whether that's necessary for everybody is a question that we can discuss.
And whether it's accessible, I'm thinking back, Sally, as you began this. Yeah, both of your Tai Chi master in Los Angeles, I believe you said, was not an American contemporary fellow, with someone from another country. And, of course, we all know Muktananda, very traditional Indian enlightened being. And you made the point that, maybe I heard you make this point, that it's perhaps easier to fall into a traditional student-teacher relationship when the teacher is very different than we are. And in our current yoga world, there aren't that many of those people around. I mean, we just lost Mr. Iyengar. And many of our listening audience are studying yoga with their, I'm just going to call them their contemporaries, other
with peers,
Americans who
more
have learned the practices. And
well,
so it gets a little tricky.
Yeah, and I would say that there's upsides and downsides of this. So, and I want to talk about it because I do think that the contemporary yoga scene is actually related to the evolutionary changes that have gone on in our very individualistic society. I know the thing that made me start thinking about this was a conversation I had a couple of years ago with one of my former assistants, actually, who's a longtime spiritual practitioner. She, I think she's been meditating for 20 years. And she's had a very winding path. She goes to lots of workshops. She studies with lots of teachers. And she had recently become involved with a teacher near where she's living who I'm not quite sure what his approach is. But at one point, they had had a conversation in the group in which she made a very strong, she took a very strong position that was not the same as his. And he busted her. He said, "You need to learn to submit to my guidance if you're going to be in this group." And she said to me, "You know, I've been contemplating what he said, and I think he's right in many ways. But at this point in my life, I have my own inner guidance, and this particular dilemma, I would say, which is very much the position of most of the yoga students that I know in the contemporary world, it's most Western seekers, most Western practitioners are strongly individualistic, have been brought up to listen to their own inner voices. And the question is the inner voice you're listening to the inner voice of God, so to speak, the inner voice of your true self, the inner voice of Dharma? Or is it the voice of your mind or of your tendencies?
Right.
And I actually think the key question that we have to answer in deep practice, who's talking to me from inside? So my feeling is that a teacher, let's say a Western teacher, an experienced Western teacher who has really put in his or her hours and done his or her practice and dealt with this question for themselves is often an extremely good guide for a contemporary or peer, for exactly the reason that she's not that she's not tied to a traditional idea about student-teacher hierarchy. So the question really is, who is your teacher? How practiced is your teacher? How willing to be transparent is your teacher? And how much does your teacher really care about your progress? And I believe we were talking about this earlier in our conversation. It's been my experience that we do find the teacher we need at the time we need that teacher. So, for me, where I was at, coming from the culture I came from, having a rigorous teacher of another tradition was critically important. And I think that part of what was going on in those days was that the Eastern way of self-cultivation was beginning to come to the West, with the kind of force that we now see the results of today, when there's so many of the deep inner teachings and the powerful esoteric traditions of the East are now very much available, very accessible in a way that they weren't before. And in a certain way, we might say that because the teachers of the old generation went through the process they went through, and because the teachers of my generation, et cetera, went through the processes we went through, that to a certain extent, we just have to assume that there has been an evolution, and that it's possible for students to come in at a place where many of them are actually carrying in their field the understandings that, for example, my generation had to kind of go through the mill in order to discover. So I would say that's one side of the issue, that actually I think there has been evolution. There's a great deal more psychological sophistication around these days than there was when I was first beginning my practice.
It is an evolutionary process having a teacher.
Yes, and it's an evolutionary process having a teacher. Traditionally, your first teacher might be, your massage therapist, which is not unusual these days, or your chiropractor, or the person
healer,
exactly.
Who enters your field with some level of awareness that they offer to you that you then rise to.
Exactly. And that meets you where you need to be met at that particular moment, which is really important.
Uh-huh. So, and I'm fascinated by this idea. And, of course, it's simple and it makes sense. I just hadn't parsed it out until you mentioned it, that the right teacher appears at the right time.
Yeah.
And that we take, then might we say we take responsibility in our practice, in our contemplative work, to understand which voice is being heard. Am I listening to the voice of my higher self? Am I listening to the voice of my lower self, my ego? That's our responsibility. And when that
is
taking place,
and
then the right teacher appears.
Yeah, and I would also say, Sarah, that a really skillful teacher can shortcut that process for you. In other words, a really skillful teacher, in whatever way is that teacher's style, can provide a mirror that can actually show you in a very immediate way where you're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, it's so.
And that can be uncomfortable. Speaking personally, that requires a level of intention around practice and a level of steadiness, because it can be very challenging to be faced with that reflection that a true teacher can give us and use it as grist, if you will, use it in that sort of anuloma kind of a way to create the friction, to light the fire of future transformation. It's hard, is what I'm saying. It's easy to bounce away from this in our culture of immediate gratification and let's avoid discomfort. This is hard work that we're speaking of.
Yes, it is, and I think that it is very important that you really want to grow. You know, there's just no way around it. Our motivation, our desire for freedom is critical in this journey, and it's also important that the teacher. And this is part of the teacher's responsibility, that the teacher be willing to stand in his or her own truth without necessarily accepting the projections of the student. You know, and speaking as a teacher, this is one of the hardest things. My teacher was once doing a personal interview with a very famous New Age spiritual leader, who was having some trouble in his community. And my teacher said to him, you know, you shouldn't be so moved by the criticism of these of your students. He said, if you're a real spiritual teacher, then you don't worry about what other people say about you. You stand in your own truth. And, you know, it's very easy to misunderstand that and think that, you know, that he's saying don't take feedback, which, of course, you know, is one of the problematic things about being a teacher. It's very important for a teacher to be able to handle feedback and to be able to look in the mirror of critique that, you know, might come from her own students or might come from peers. But on the other hand, it's also very important that a teacher not be constantly trying to please everybody. Mm-hmm. And I, what I see is one of the great, great dangers, issues that comes up between students and teachers is the issue of you know, what in psychology they call transference and counter-transference. And, you know, that on the one hand, the student will project all of her, you know, her longings for the perfect lover or the perfect parent, you know, or the best friend onto the teacher and, you know, fall in love with the teacher, or get, you know, or project all their issues about the parent that, you know, that they don't feel happy about onto the teacher and get angry at the teacher. And there's, you know, there's a whole drama that goes on between students and teachers. We've all seen it. So, exactly. And in a certain sense, it's part of the beauty of the student-teacher relationship that you project all your stuff onto the teacher, and the teacher just stands there. If, you know, if the teacher is really standing in her truth or in his truth and mirrors back to you what you're projecting towards him, and you get to see yourself. You know, you go, oh, okay, I'm doing the same thing with my teacher that I did with my 16-year-old self, you know, that at 16 I did with my boyfriend, or I'm treating her the way I, you know, treated my mother.
Right.
And so that it's very valuable in that way. But what often happens is that the teacher, you know, gets a counter-transference. So the teacher, you know, starts loving the authority that the students are projecting onto her, or starts believing that, you know, the student who's in love with him might be the perfect mate, and then all kinds of shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
You know, then
and again, we see that in the complexity the intensity of the student-teacher relationship in our world today. And as you're speaking, I'm thinking to cultivate ourselves to that level of steadiness and discernment as teachers, we've just got to have a rock solid practice ourselves. Otherwise,
Absolutely. How
can we keep the field clear and have discernment in the face of the various issues, both spoken and unspoken, that our students will bring to us?
Totally, totally. The practice is absolutely essential. And what's also essential is humility. You know, is really accepting the fact that maybe you don't know everything and maybe you have weaknesses that you haven't seen. And in a certain sense, constantly putting the questions, the deep questions of your life, into the hands of the self, into the hands of the higher power, so that you know, you suspect, you actually are constantly clarifying your own motives and desires and assumptions. So I have just found that the great value, one of the great values for me of having been so fortunate to have, you know, to be able to spend my life as a teacher, is that you're constantly being called on your weaknesses and your insecurities and your arrogance and all the other qualities that, you know, can arise in a situation with students. So, you know, I always find that if I keep thinking of my life as a teacher as actually being a part of my sadhana, you know, that this is part of the sadhana, part of the practice that I've been given
to
in
hold
this life.
That space.
And I think it's why teaching is a privilege, and why people who get serious about their yoga practice want to teach, you know, if it's coming from a deep place, is because we realize that when you're standing in the position of being the channel for the teachings, you're asked to be really transparent. You know, you're asked to be your clearest self. And what a great opportunity it is to have, you know, to have that asked of you.
And to move more deeply into your own self-knowing and then offer yourself as a teacher from that place.
Yeah.
And one of the questions that we had tossed around that you said you weren't sure you could answer was my question, that, and it's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of a fey kind of a question, but I had asked this, is Google the new guru? Because we can access information, and I'm putting that in quotes. If you were in my living room, you'd see me doing the quotation marks with my fingers. Because we can access so much information, for example, let's say I want a mantra for a certain purpose. I can Google that right now and get that mantra.
Yeah.
And have that information. I probably could even find a recording of it with someone, you know, a monk from Thailand giving the correct pronunciation for this mantra that I might be seeking for whatever purpose I had determined was before me. But that's very different than sitting with a teacher. And this is what we're facing now. Information and transmission, there are differences there. And sadhana, at a certain part of our trajectory, is dependent on sangha. So these are fancy words, but our spiritual study in certain parts of the arc of our journey, our spiritual study is very dependent on the people that we spend time with.
Very dependent. It's crucial. Yeah, it's crucial.
And then there's another time in that arc where, as you described earlier, we might turn more to a more quiet and contemplative inner life using community selectively. So this is this arc of transformation that we also wanted to touch on for our listeners today. Sally, I think it's one of the things that you have such a beautiful and refined perspective on, given the arc of your own experience and being teacher to so many students. There is a transformative arc and a mystical unfoldment that we, if we move beyond the poses in yoga, presumably we're all putting our feet on that path.
Yeah, and just to answer your question about Google, which is, I think, a hilarious question, but very timely, yes, you can get the highest, most esoteric teachings of the East on Google. And I've discovered that, as I'm sure you have, that if you have a question about a mantra, you can go on Google and you can get it answered from five different teachers in five different ways. I just went through this process with a mantra that I've been interested in, and I discovered that there's one of the things about the spiritual journey in the East is that teachers from different parts of the country have A, different pronunciations, B, different interpretations, 3, do the mantras differently. So you can take your pick. And in a certain sense, when you have that much choice, you're kind of on your own, because the downside of that is that you actually don't know what's correct if you can get five different responses to your question. So that's another reason, I believe, why Sangam and why really seeking teachers and spending time with teachers face to face or through a CD or a video, but actually spending enough time with a teacher to find out if the teacher really knows what they're talking about, and above all, if you have a connection, because, you know, you can meet amazing people, and if there's no connection, if there's no spark between you, their wisdom won't transform you. It won't affect you.
Yeah.
And you can meet people who are actually much less accomplished, but because there's a connection, something can be transmitted between you that can be very powerful, very strong. So it's always about really going about the business of spiritual transformation with a lot of attention to the way it's entering you and sitting in you, and the way that you know that your daily life is affected by the practice that you're doing. But in terms of the transformation process, which, as you say, you're right, it's something I've been tremendously interested in over the years. And interestingly enough, there are some classic paradigms that the different traditions give us about what the spiritual journey looks like, and they agree in some ways and not in others. But I would say there are four movements to everybody's path, and that one of the things that's very important to understand is that these movements happen in a spiral. So for example, most of us, many of us, because we tend to be linear minded, we imagine that the spiritual journey is a straight climb or precipitous fall, sort of. But in fact, the spiritual journey is a spiral. It's a path that generally moves higher or deeper, but often in what seems like a kind of a roundabout fashion. And for most of us, the path is marked by a series of awakenings at deeper and deeper levels to what is the purpose of our life. And the initial awakenings may be very dramatic. My initial awakening was extremely dramatic. But I know people who had the simplest little sort of intimation that, maybe it would be a good idea to go to a yoga class, and that decision became the basis for a turnaround in their lives I've seen that happen to somebody in 3 weeks after their first yoga class. It's mm-hmm. a really extraordinary
right.
thing,
right?
And I'm sure you have students like that.
Yeah. What appears to be a casual decision, your friend says, "Let's go to yoga," or you're at your local college. I get this. I live in a town with a university, and I have students that say, "Well, they were offering a yoga class, and I went, and nothing's been the same since."
Yeah, I know. It's so extraordinary the power that these practices have. The way they can touch that in you that really connects you to your depths. And so this initial awakening happens, and then normally, if we're taking it seriously, if we're taking ourselves seriously, we then find ourselves either with a practice or looking for a practice. And again, the arc is different for different people. For some people, it really depends on temperament, but for some people, once you start practicing, you're practicing. You're doing it every day. You're spending hours at it. You're turning down invitations to parties because you want to do your practice. And for other people, it seems much more casual. I know because I teach meditation, which is actually harder for many people to get into than asana practice, simply because it's so subtle, and our minds are so distracted. Whereas with asana practice, you do something with your body and you actually can see yourself making progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people refer to asana as the gateway drug. I've heard it said that way.
That's great.
Asana is the gateway drug, and we are embodied, and it makes perfect sense. I came to yoga to touch my toes because I was a super athlete and my hamstrings were too tight.
Mm.
And that was my motivation. Gee, maybe yoga can help me prevent injury in my legs. And the next thing I knew, I was on this transformational trajectory that I then will never take my feet off of.
Yeah.
So yeah, we come through the body, and then we might move beyond the poses, and meditation can be challenging.
I think I find meditation is often challenging for yoga students. I think partly because when we're attracted to the physical forms of yoga, it's because we're athletic, or because we get high through the body, as it were, if you don't mind my using that phrase. So, and I know for me, I went through a period where I ran a lot, and I had been meditating for 10 or 15 years when I started running. But what I discovered was that running got me high quicker than anything I'd ever done. And I think, that's true for many of us. You get more endorphins rushing through your system, moving fast, moving your body fast than you do in just about anything. So it's a very accessible way to touch into the bliss realm, of the self is through the body. Whereas with meditation and with, more contemplative practices, you have to deal much more directly with the distractions of the mind and the kind of amorphousness of your own inner journey. So it's very tempting for people when meditation is their gateway to find a practice that, to receive a practice and to then just keep on doing it mindlessly, as it were, or, without contemplating why they're doing it. Or alternatively, it's very easy to, do a meditation practice that you get from a teacher at your studio and get another practice off the internet and just keep trying one thing and another and never going deep. And I would say that once you've made a commitment to practice regularly, that then you enter a phase which the old Christian contemplatives call purification. It's not something, right, that is exactly adored by contemporary Westerners, the idea that purification is necessary.
Sit in your stuff.
Sit in your stuff, exactly.
Yeah.
Work with
your
stuff. Skillful purification, what I would call skillful purification, is a combination of practices. You sit and you allow yourself to see your stuff arising, and you hold steady with it, you witness it. But I also feel that there are certain practices that are very important that can actually accelerate the process. And of course, certain asanas are really powerful, powerfully purificatory. Pranayama is incredibly purificatory. So when you're getting deep into practice, what's very important, and I think this is one reason why it's great to have an experienced teacher, is because a teacher can say to you, okay, here's where I see you've got a lot of schmutz in your body. Here's where your mind is kind of wandering, or hey, you have a problem with feeling unworthy. So here's a way that you can start to like yourself better. So I mean, the thing about a powerful practice is that, to my mind, it's full court press. It's not just about the yoga of the body. It's not just about meditative yoga. It also is going to include some kind of skillful processes for dealing with your psychological detritus, with your stuff. And we're so lucky these days that there's been a kind of marriage of Eastern spiritual techniques with some of the skillful Western techniques that can actually help you look at your psychological wounding or your tendencies and work with them on the psychological level as well as from a spiritual point of view. So I think it really accelerates the process profoundly.
And so this acceleration is a result of the integration of different understandings that are available to us, and also teachers can allow us to be so much, a skillful teacher can allow a lot of efficiency on this transformative journey. They can help move us along by providing reflection, support, adjustment. And so that's just my experience of going it on my own versus having a teacher, is it's just much more efficient.
It's much more efficient.
Yeah.
It is. And if the teacher is both highly experienced and willing to work with you personally, which is, you know, a wonderful thing if your teacher will spend enough time with you to see you, it can actually just move you along at an incredibly fast pace. And I do think one of the skills that experienced Western teachers have is precisely this, you know, that Western teachers have some psychological competencies that the traditional Eastern teachers may not have had developed so much. So, you know, and also they understand the way the typical Western mind works.
Yeah.
They know what your mother issues might be. They know what your relationship, wounds might be. They assume that you're probably dealing with some stuff that can't be swept under the rug.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a contemporization that's taking place, and as we wrap it up, our conversation, and we could go on for hours. You have so much to offer, Sally. I find myself just deeply diving into the implications of so much of what you're saying. I'm curious, as we finish our time today, what you see, who are the next generation of yoga teachers? You've talked about this integrated approach. We have yoga and psychology, I think. You know, I'm a big fan of Venn diagrams. Remember the two circles? They come together in like the Olympic rings.
Yeah.
Where they overlap is where the action is. Do we have psychology and yoga now creating that Venn diagram? And is that a directionality that you see for yoga so that this idea of moving beyond the poses, using the poses as the gateway and yoga as a way to transform our lives, to live with freedom, authenticity, grace, and power. Will we see emerge? What's the future looking like to you?
Oh, really great question. I do believe that the merging of yoga and psychology is very powerful and very important, and it's something that started in the, you know, around the 80s and 90s with Buddhist psychologists starting to integrate Buddhist ideas and mindfulness practice, etc., with their psychotherapeutic practice, and I see it a lot in the Buddhist world, and I'm just starting to see it in the yoga world.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that it's unbelievably helpful to have that peace in your practice and to have teachers be psychologically skillful enough to know how to speak to those issues when they come up for you. So, yeah, for sure. I think it's something that you touched on as well, that if yoga practice, if the spiritual path is about living with power, authenticity, love, skill, you know, in other words, having a full life in the world that's also helpful to others and being able to raise a family in a way that contributes to the evolution of humanity and the planet and, you know, do your work so that it's both satisfying and helpful and all those things that I think we all want in our life. Yoga is unbelievably powerful and important in that project. and that what I believe is the great gift of our time is that more and more people understand that yoga is not just on the mat. It's not just for the ashram. It's not just for special people, you know, who want to give their lives to it. It really is a life-transforming path that anybody can follow, and that the world, you know, really is demanding that more and more of us start to recognize the importance of, because at the core of yoga is this recognition of our interdependence, you know, our non-duality, and to be able to really truthfully experience the profound non-dual connection that we have to the planet and to each other. I don't know another way that allows us to really have that be an experience and not just an intellectual belief, except the practice of the internal yoga.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. And my experience in yoga, which is about now 16 years, I see an increasingly vibrant opportunity to take yoga off the mat, to live our yoga. We're beginning to see these phrases, this marriage of yoga and psychology, this idea of mindfulness even coming into our elementary schools. If we see this evolutionary spiral that you've described, and we turn our face to the sun, if you will, and see that consciousness insists on continuing to blossom and manifest and to buoy us, there are many markers in our world we can become aware of that show us that consciousness offers itself to us over and over and over again. It's ours to pick up in that most loving and ferocious way to make our lives full, free, authentic, graceful, and contributory.
Beautiful.
That's, to me, the idea of yoga beyond the poses.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what you said about consciousness offering us the opportunities, the signals, the clues, you know, the openings, is so important.
Yeah.
And I do believe that, you know, that one of the gifts of yoga practice is to be able to pick those up, you know, to follow that breadcrumb trail.
To notice.
To notice, to see, and to be able to act on it confidently and to have what the English call the bottom. I love that phrase, you know, they say somebody has bottom, meaning they have character.
Ah.
And it's a great, and to me it has, isn't that a great word? It's like,
yes,
it's like,
I like that.
You know,
in my lexicon now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
from a practical standpoint, what can we leave our listeners with? From a practical standpoint, how do they find that bottom? How might we ground ourselves and get our feet on this transformational path? We've talked about the role of teacher, the role of some kind of contemplative meditative practice, the role of asana. We haven't touched on Ayurveda, which is one of my loves, which is a whole other piece that our listeners can tap into in some of our other conversation. But what might we leave people with, Sally, from where you sit with the wisdom you've accrued, someone with this deep longing to allow consciousness to lift them in this spiral? What advice would you give?
I would say, I'm very much about what lets me cut to the chase. So to me, there are two practices that are utterly indispensable, and one of them is heart focus, like actually learning how to center in that region behind the chest that we call the heart, which is in so many ways the center of being for a human being, and that the more you can center yourself in the heart, the more you become able to receive the deeper messages, the deeper understandings that are coming from awareness itself and from the people in the world around you, and in a way that lets you actually remain centered. So that's one. Another is self-inquiry. I think that the question of the intention really to keep asking yourself moment by moment, who am I really? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? You know, those three classic questions, they come up in different ways. Mm-hmm. But that inquiry is what creates the frame for sanity in just about every situation. And the third one that I've found indispensable is that once you've found the heart space center, that you then begin to create your relationships around a sense of your own heart presence, the energy in your own heart, of the presence of the heart in somebody else. And also, and this is, I think, a kind of radical thing that we're just exploring now in the spiritual world, also to begin to be able to be very conscious and present to the space that connects us, so that we're less and less seeing ourselves as kind of islands of impenetrable personal consciousness, and more as, you know, as mutual energy fields who are connected to each other by the energy that, you know, that comes up between you and I, or that comes up between you and the deer, or you and the dog, or you and the tree, and that combination of a very direct heart-centered intention, the intention to constantly inquire, who am I really? What am I doing? What are my motivations? What are my goals? You know, that just moment by moment inquiry, and the recognition of connection. That if we can make those three intentions and practices paramount, then everything we do, you know, whatever asana we're doing, whatever form of meditation we're doing, is going to keep turning us back to the fundamental fact of, you know, our connection to the essence within, our connection to each other, and the connection to Dharma that you get through self-inquiry.
Beautiful. How beautifully sustainable. And when what comes to mind is this idea of how we're noticing that our connection to the planet needs to be refined, that we can't ignore our planetary, our air, our water, et cetera. When we do that and ignore it, it just fouls our own nest.
Yeah.
That we are interconnected, that this path of consciousness is dependent. It will be most graceful and powerful when that deep integration of interconnectivity to self, to others, and all beings is in place. And you're making it sound really accessible. Now let's let our listeners know how they can connect more deeply to these teachings, Sally. I know that you're bringing these practices into the world using technology. People can study with you regardless of where they live, correct? They don't have to find you in person. This is your dharma too. It feels to me that you are putting this out there, and you have an invitation for people. How can they find you?
So I have a website, sallykempton.com, easy to find. And on my website, there's a button on the top which says where I am and what my schedule is. And I, as you said, Sarah, I give monthly teleconference classes on different topics of spiritual life, some very meditative, some on issues like, you know, how do you practice in hard times, and how do you work with karma. Right now I'm doing a series on the goddesses, the goddesses of the Indian pantheon, called The Goddess Empowerment, which I'm doing for the Shift Network. That's on its second week. It goes for 7 weeks. And I have a couple of books, which you mentioned, that you can find out about on my website. And I have my Facebook page is called Sally Kempton Awakened Heart, one word, on Facebook. And the teleconferences I've found are incredibly powerful for creating a sense of community connection, and also just letting us practice kind of deeply, wherever we are. you know, the teachings are so amplified by the community connection that happens in these teleclasses. It's been a kind of an amazing learning for me to see how powerful this telecommunications can be in so many people's journey.
Yeah, that information alone does not equal transformation.
No, it's all about transformation.
Otherwise, Google would be the guru.
Yes, exactly.
We need to come together and support one another and access teachers in order for the information to be transmitted in a way that allows for transformation. And this is happening, by the way, you and I both know, to not just rarefied people who don't have to have a regular job and can stay home and,
yeah,
you know, practice and eat lentils all day. That's not the case at all. There are yogis hiding in plain sight in your local Starbucks, your local public schools. There are people participating due to the blessings of technology in learning these transformative techniques and being supported in bringing them into their daily life. And they're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
And I find this such an exciting time. We could certainly say how catastrophic world events are, and it would be true. But I think we can also say that through the grace that we receive, the grace of awareness in our practice, we begin to notice that crumb trail that you talked about, and that it is leading to up that spiral to greater awareness,
yeah,
in
totally,
many, many people. And this is what buoys me. This is Yoga Beyond the Poses.
This is Yoga Beyond the Poses. Beautiful. Beautiful.
So,
thank you,
Sally.
Much,
thank you so very, very much. And I would encourage
pleasure.
All of our listeners to Google Sally Kempton, sallykempton.com. Many offerings that are convenient for you. You can also certainly find Sally in person. She teaches in a variety of lovely locations, and Sally, you're collaborating with a lot of wonderful teachers, and so you're making yourself so accessible. I just want to acknowledge and bow to that, your wisdom flowing out in so many ways to benefit the world.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yes, and I'd like to invite you all to the retreat that Sianna Sherman and I are doing in Maui in late October. There are, I think, about 6 places left. If someone on this call is called, Sianna's an amazing yoga teacher and priestess, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
beautiful.
And
who doesn't want to go to Maui with Sally?
And who doesn't want to go to Maui? Exactly.
So sallykempton.com will get you there. Also, well, not to Maui, but to the information. You'll need a credit card to get to Maui. So, Sally, many, many blessings, and I bow deeply
blessings
to your presence in our world. Thank you so much.
And I bow right back to you, Sarah. It's been great, and I know that this whole series is going to be amazing for people. So, blessings.
Lovely. Let's bring more people to yoga and beyond, and it's just simply my dharma to help make the world a better place. So
beautiful.
Simple stuff. Let's do our practices and see each other soon.
Yes, may it be so.
All right. Be sure to join us for the next session, and we encourage you to engage with us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/yogawisdomandwellness. That's facebook.com/yogawisdomandwellness. We would love to hear your comments about this conversation and about our telesummit. Remember, you can listen online for 48 hours after every talk completely free. And if you would like lifetime access to all of these wonderful sessions, there's a special Yoga Wisdom playlist that also includes written transcripts. It's available to you at yogawisdomplaylist.com. You can find out all the details about owning the recordings that you can listen to anytime and anywhere, and also having written transcripts of each talk. Thank you so much. And to
Thank
our
you.
Listening audience, namaste.
Namaste.